In a world of super-fast information exchange, swiftly evolving technologies, and rapidly surfacing social, political, and environmental stressors, workers might rightly worry if they can keep pace. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking this hour about what the jobs of the future might look like. We are going to discuss the future of work and workers, and welcome your questions and your views for our guest futurist. Our guest will share a vision of tomorrow's workplace and what it means for present and future generations. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Rebecca Ryan, a futurist, economist, founder and owner of Next Generation Consulting. She is also resident futurist at the Alliance for Innovation, a senior fellow at CEOs for Cities, and senior advisor at the Governing Institute. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us. Now, this past weekend, you delivered a TEDx talk in which you say America is seasonal. What season is America currently in, and what does that mean?
Well, for all of us who are bracing for this winter storm in Wisconsin this weekend, we are, seasonally, America is in winter. We are in a period of economic stagnation and some social recession, and this wintertime period cycles every fourth generation. So it really is a season in the truest sense of the word.
So this has been going on since 9/11, you say?
Right. I think it started in 2001. And then, like every one of our previous winters, this is our fourth one, it sort of starts with this one spark, you know, and this was the World Trade Center's being hit, and it sets off this chain reaction of, the technical term I think is yuck, and you know, then we find ourselves feeling pretty frozen and pretty stuck, hence winter.
Yes, yeah, so we are in a season of yuck, you say, even with a governmental leadership. We feel as though our politicians are not helping us out.
Yeah, and you know, as a futurist, one of the things I know is that policies and governance tend to be the most reactive to change. So this isn't unusual. In our previous winters, it also has felt like government was the last to change. So we shouldn't probably be based on the past, we shouldn't be expecting Washington, D.C. to be leading the charge on this. It's going to come from the grassroots up.
Yeah, and we are, other symptoms of us being in winter, the unrest that we're seeing, protests we're seeing, Black Lives Matter, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. You know, it often happens that the seeds for the next winter are planted a couple seasons beforehand. So the civil rights movement in the 1960s, you know, we passed the best civil rights legislation that's been passed in this country and in our lifetime, following President Kennedy's death. That was very much enabling legislation. And we saw the middle class, the African-American middle class, expand for a while and then kind of flatline out. So we do have these institutionalized problems that we now are trying to pull apart and feel very stuck in this winter period.
So what does this winter period mean for workers?
Yeah. Mm. Well, you know, traditionally in winter, it's been a time when America has really asked, who are we for and what are we for? And one of the things that I think workers need to be aware of, individuals need to be aware of, is winter tends to be a reset period, a regeneration period. So if we want to go back to the manufacturing of my dad's era, those jobs really have been going away since the 1970s. So for workers, this is not a time to be nostalgic. This is a time to say, all right, what is coming? And how do I need to retool? Do I need to go back to school if I have felt shut out of the current environment? So the workforce, we know, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, there's going to be more technology. It's more of a gig economy now, where we have more short-term assignments. The 33-year job just doesn't exist anymore.
as I'm in my 30th year at Wisconsin Public Radio. That's right. I mean, the workers of tomorrow are going to switch jobs and switch careers multiple times.
And you're seeing it already. I mean, even at WPR,
yeah,
right?
Right?
Producers come in, they come out. It's unusual for somebody to stay with a single employer for all of their lives. And as an economist, I get excited about that in some ways because it shows that the labor force has a lot of oxygen in it and a lot of fluidity, which can be great for organizations. Unfortunately, it really cuts at the security that people feel that they need in order to make long-term investments in things or to buy a house or, you know, some
right.
of these things that drive the economy.
Well, you also, in that talk, remind us that we are currently in, we currently have the biggest gap between the rich and the poor. Is this gap likely to widen or narrow in the future?
I think it would take some fundamental restructuring for that gap to narrow. And so there's the data that the middle class is as imperiled as it's been. That's the data. But what does that mean? Well, what research shows us is that when you have a thinner middle class and you have bigger populations at the margins, you have more social problems. You have less trust. You have more violence. A lot of the things like police and health and social services, budgets for those things have to go up as there's a smaller middle class. Now, what are some of the big changes? I know that some politicals are talking a lot about increasing the minimum wage, but that would go a long way towards helping. I think in my last book, I wrote about what Mr. Ford did when he said every worker will be paid, you know, $5 a day for work. And that was amazing. And it gave a lot of those were and they're, you know, they had to come and show up on time and they couldn't be slackers and
yeah.
all those kinds of things. But his long-term view was he wanted a workforce that could afford his vehicles.
Right.
And it fundamentally helped lift so many people into the middle class.
Well, you know, though, that there is this movement to try to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour now. But I also saw a photograph in the paper the other day of a McDonald's that had computers instead of workers taking orders.
That's
and,
right.
And we hear businesses say, if you're going to raise the minimum wage to that amount, we're going to start replacing workers with computers.
Yeah, there is a threshold. I believe the number I've seen most recently is any job that can be performed for $20 an hour or less is pretty ripe for automation. And there's a group of British economists who have, it was pretty speculative, but they've said up to 50% of the jobs could be automated. I don't think we're going to get to that point, but that's real.
Yeah. So, what about the future of that service job? I mean, will there be mostly automated computers taking our orders at fast food restaurants?
I think to a point there will be. I think about Applebee's and Uno, you know, Pizzeria Uno. They've been some of the earliest
That's
adopters.
Right.
There are still staff who are working. They are expediting your orders. They're making sure that your order is correct. But, you know, they say that it can be a win-win for both the worker and for the consumer, because the consumer doesn't have to wait for the staff person to come over and take their dessert order. They can just plug it in. So it's, you know, it turns tables over more so that wait staff gets more tips, you know, on a volume basis per night.
So how else do you see technology redefining the workplace?
Well, I think the biggest, when I think of it from the sort of the 30,000 foot level, and I think about my dad who worked at the West Bend Company. He was there for 33 years, and work was a place he went because he was supervising the second shift of people who made pots, pans, eventually popcorn poppers,
yep.
the best popcorn.
I remember? Had those.
Did you have the stir crazy popcorn?
I did, I think. I did it, the air popper, too.
Yeah, the air popper, yes, yes. We ate a lot of popcorn at my house.
Yeah.
Still do. But, you know, work was where he went. And for this next generation, work is something you do. You know, I've got a teammate with me in the other room who is working right now, not at a desk. She's sitting next to your producer working. So I think that's the biggest shift, and technology has certainly enabled that. But on the other hand, Joy, some of the things that, you know, technology always gets the headline like, oh, wow, now we can work anytime, any place. But when it really comes down to it, what some of the best place to work research is showing is that it really is about relationships and connection. So the more things change, the more they stay the same in some respects.
We are talking with Rebecca Ryan. She is a futurist, an economist, founder and owner of Next Generation Consulting. She's talking with us about the future of work. We noticed in some national publications some series that are being run at this time on the future of work, and we thought of Rebecca and wanted to get her thoughts on what will the future job look like, and welcome your questions or your thoughts. What worries or excites you about the future of work? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the future of work and workers with Rebecca Ryan, who is a futurist. She's half futurist, half economist. She lives in Madison. She also just did a TED Talk on future trends. And in that TED Talk, she mentioned that we are now in the season of winter, where we're resetting and preparing for the future. Rebecca, I wanted to know what would spring look like, and how will we know when it's here?
Yeah, so I'm thinking for your listeners right now, it might be interesting to just think, as you think about the community that you live in, your neighborhood, if you're working, like if you're listening to this at work right now, think about the company you work for. I love to survey people and ask which part of winter do they think they're in. Do they think they're in like the deep freeze, like, ooh, things are still frozen and stuck, people aren't making investments, we're not hiring new people? Do they feel that there's a thaw, that people are becoming a little more optimistic? Or do they feel like new growth, like spring is coming, we can see the green is starting to come back into the grass? And I do probably 40 speeches every year, and I ask this question of my audiences, and I can tell you that the percentage who feel like we're in deep winter is now less than 30%, and the percentage who feel like we're in thaw or coming into spring is well over half in all of these audiences. And so what that says to me is, you know, spring is coming in sort of on schedule. We estimate that the whole country will be out of it by 2020 or 2021, because each of these seasons lasts about a generation.
It's interesting. So do we have to do anything to prepare for 2021?
Well, it's interesting, you know, in doing research on kind of coming out of this winter to spring, I went back and I looked at all the previous wintertime periods, and there have been three: the American Revolution, Civil War and Reconstruction, and the Great Depression. And when I looked at how we turned, you know, from winter to spring, very often one of the key things that happens is there's always a faction that wants to hang on to the way it was in the previous seasonal cycle. In the American Revolution, the best example of this are the Loyalists. They were very loyal to Britain. They had it really good under the British flag. But the Patriots were the people who said, hey, we have this chance to create a country that's not based on if you won the ovarian lottery and you were born to a family that owned land. We have an ability to form a country that isn't, you know, loyal to the Church of England, and we could have religious freedom. And so it took a war, but the Patriots eventually, you know, won, and the Loyalists lost. And I think one of the things to know is that when we go from these winter to spring arcs, it is usually it's fraught with tension, because both sides are working so hard. One side to hang on to what has always been, and the other side to say, but there could be an even brighter tomorrow. And eventually those who believe and are organized and work across invisible lines for the better tomorrow end up winning.
Well, we have lots of callers, and
awesome.
But I do want to ask a little bit about this spring. Will that be that's going to be the full transition to the, you know, the knowledge economy, the sharing economy, that's when we say goodbye to that, you know, that manufacturing economy?
Do you want me to take that?
Yes.
Now? Okay, perfect. I don't think the manufacturing economy will ever die. but I do think it's being regenerated right now. When you think about 3D printing and a lot of the technologies that are, you can buy a 3D printer right now for $900.
Wow.
I know there's a writer for the New York Times who printed their dinner off their 3D printer. So that's pretty amazing. So what I think is going to happen to manufacturing is we're going to have more artisanal manufacturing, more niche manufacturing, and sort of the mass consumption of crap, in a lot of cases, of junk is going to get redistributed and redivided. And I think that's part of the future of manufacturing.
Interesting. What about the so-called sharing economy? Is that going to grow?
I think it is, because our next generation of millennials, you know, it's interesting thinking back to the winters. There's always this group called the lost generation, because the economy and society shifts as they're coming up. And so for millennials right now, who have the highest levels of college debt, they're the most underemployed of any generation of the last four. They are fundamentally resetting what it means to be an American. So a young woman said to me, why do I want to own a drill when all I really need is a hole from time to time? So these tool lending libraries that are popping up in neighborhoods, in communities, the Oakland Library in Oakland, California now will loan you a library book, but they will also loan you a rototiller. You just have to return it with gas back in it and so forth. So I think the sharing economy is definitely is here to stay. And what needs to happen now, of course, is we need policies that can protect people in the sharing economy. And we also have to figure out how we can fund budgets, because, for example, in Madison, right, we've got, or in Wisconsin generally, we get a lot of revenue from hotel taxes, right? Those sometimes go back into the general fund, or they feed into convention and visitors bureaus. Well, if Airbnb takes people out of our hotel rooms so that you stay in private people's homes instead, that's less money for the commons. So we do have to figure out how policy is going to catch up with the sharing economy, but I don't see it going away.
Very funny, because when I bought a drill once, and I didn't even drill that one hole, I have to share that with somebody.
List it on your next door app, so somebody can borrow it.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have a question or a thought, an observation on the future of work. And Boyd in Wautoma is with us. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Joy, and hello to your guest. I think she brings up some good points, and they're all very relevant, but I really think there are going to be some very dark days ahead still, because we're predominantly in a service-based economy, and with those switching over to computers, that's really going to, I think, just put a lot of people out of work. I think those British economists were spot on. I do think, though, people are going to really find what they're really, really good at and become independent contractors, whatever that niche is, because they just realize going into the workforce and clocking in and clocking out is becoming a thing of the past. But there's going to be a lot of pain ahead before we even remotely get to that. It may not even happen in like my lifetime or many lifetimes.
Is Boyd onto something?
Yeah, he is. And, you know, I love this call, because I am a glass half full gal.
Mm-hmm.
And Boyd is right. I mean, most of the jobs, the most common jobs in the U.S. are retail sales, cashiers, food and beverage services, office clerk. And as he said, this is a service. You know, when the industrial economy blew up, we created a service economy around it. And now technology can automate some of these things in the service economy. So we are going through another sort of a fundamental reset. But the silver lining, even Boyd has a little bit of optimism in him, is that people are able, I think, to be more. We're not going to be paid for time in the future. We're probably going to be paid for value. We're going to be paid for the value of tasks. So you're already seeing this with, you know, what's been sometimes called the gig economy, you know, that I do three or four jobs to give my life some meaning and some financial structure. But I'm not beholden to a single employer. There's no fealty to a single employer. And that can be, again, as an economist, that can be very good for the economy, because it can be a more efficient division of labor, and it can put more oxygen into organizations.
Now, are we holding all of those gigs at the same time?
Very often. So, you know, I've got friends who have four or five things going at any one time.
Yeah,
you know,
like what?
Yeah, so you know, somebody might be an associate professor at the local Madison College or the local technical college, and they're doing some consulting on the side, and you know, they might be doing a couple of shifts baristing somewhere, and then maybe they're doing a volunteer thing. So, and I was just talking to one of Madison's premier career coaches yesterday, Donna Beesman, and she talked about how retirees are really looking at a portfolio, right? So some paid work, some volunteer work, some lifelong learning, and then maybe a little recreation to boot.
Yeah, and my retired husband is a part-time yoga instructor.
So. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's a task that he gets paid for, but it's a gig.
It's a gig.
Yeah.
So you've got one living under your own roof. Somebody in the gig economy.
And so independent contractors, do you agree that that's what we're going to do, kind of? Or
I do think it's already moving in that direction. I mean, when you look at Google or Facebook or a lot of the tech companies, a lot of these folks are independent contractors, and it just allows organizations to be more agile. I'm not saying that that's good or bad, because I do think that there's something to be said for having long-time, full-time workforce. It provides organizations with a lot of stability on the plus, but on the minus, it can cause stagnation. There's research that shows that teams sort of reach their apex of working together after 3 to 5 years. And then after that point, if you want fresh ideas and new thinking, you got to upset that in some sort of way.
Well, what about Rebecca? I remember, I'm an aging baby boomer, and I remember reading some time ago that when all the baby boomers retire, or when most of the baby boomers retired, there was going to be a severe labor shortage. Is that still the case?
Well, if all the baby boomers would be retiring, that might be the case.
But we're not retiring.
We're not retiring because you guys, the boomers, I'm a generation behind you, I'm a Gen Xers, you guys had this economic recession that significantly messed with any retirement savings that you had. So retirement ages will be pushed back, will increasingly be pushed back for boomers, or they will do what your husband's doing, which is participate in the gig economy. And we're not going to have the joblessness from the baby boomers that we once thought.
That we thought. Okay. To the phones again, and Rachel in Pewaukee is with us. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks.
I have a question for the guest in regards to education. So I'm very fortunate in where my dad was always in computers, and I've always been around computers. I've worked in tech support for the past 8 years. I'm only 26, so I've got a lot of learning left to do yet, but I'm very fortunate in where I know how to support computers. And my concern is for maybe, you know, rural areas or low-income areas, where they don't have the education for supporting the computers and supporting the technology of the future, you know, how does that look in regards to education?
I appreciate your question, Rachel. And how lucky were you to have a dad who worked in computers? And so for you, that's probably like a second language that you speak fluently. I think one of the big game changers here is going to be when the telephone was kind of the new technology, and there was a lot of brouhaha about getting telephone service to the last mile, you know, out into the rural areas. There are many very forward-looking states and cities who are saying high-speed internet now needs to be the new utility. It is something that, like electricity, like clean running water, no American should be without, no resident should be without. And when that happens, and I think we will see that in my lifetime, when that happens, that is going to transform so many things. I think about the massive online open courses that are being offered by MIT and by Harvard, and what that can do to transform, you know, beleaguered public schools who couldn't normally afford to have, you know, great teachers, and how we can put so many more tools of learning into the hands of young people everywhere, not just rural folks, but even inner city kids who might not have that capability to get access to that. So I think the answer to the question is, in the short term, it might continue to be a bit of a challenge in rural areas. But longer term, I feel like high-speed internet is going to be a public utility that's going to be available to everyone.
We are talking about the future of work and workers with Rebecca Ryan, who is a futurist, an economist, and founder and owner of Next Generation Consulting. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for her, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Caleb in Milwaukee. Hi, Caleb.
Hey, Joy. Thanks for having me on, and congratulations on your 30th year.
Well, thanks. It's actually in 2016. I spoke 6 months ahead of time.
It's okay. Close enough. I totally agree with, I love this. I love everything about this. And I live in Milwaukee. I commute to Chicago. I work in horticulture. So I'm a grower. And talk about a job that you don't make a lot of money, but you feel good about yourself, feel good about what you do. But I'm getting to the point where I realize that I need to, I just need to do something else. Because I can't afford the commute. I can't afford to do this for the rest of my life, even though I'd like to. So I decided a few months ago to open my own business. It's called Yard Bars. And essentially what I do is build bars for your backyard.
Wait, what do I want a bar in my backyard for?
So you can drink, Joy.
I love it. Is that really the kind of bar you're talking about, Caleb?
That's the kind of bar I'm talking about.
Oh, cool.
Socialize, have fun. Instead of a patio, why not have a bar? That's another outlet, and that's what you're talking about. To find these different things, these little things you can do, and I don't know. I think this is a great conversation, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
And I think you're quite the entrepreneur. What an idea.
He's also a futurist. Caleb, congratulations. Do you build yard bars in Madison? Would you come to Madison?
Yeah.
I would come to Madison.
Awesome.
Hey, I want a yardbar.com.
Okay. All right. That's great. I think when I say Caleb's a futurist, one of the things we do as futurists is we imagine plausible scenarios for the future of the economy. In my case, I work a lot with cities, so I help cities think about what their plausible futures are. And what Caleb has hit on here is if I was going to do futuring for America generally, there is one plausible future where things do get economically tighter and tighter and tighter. And in that scenario where things get tighter and tighter, we do have to do more gigs to kind of piece our income together. But we also have more time for leisure, and typically we do that with people we love. So social cohesion can really go up during lean economic times. I know that in my neighborhood, we are a neighborhood that really cares for each other, and it's wonderful, and that started in part out of need in our community. So that's wonderful. But even in another scenario, let's say that America just continues to rapidly grow, and even if we continue to have this huge divide between the 1% and everybody else, the 1% wants the best possible amenities, so yard bars are going to be great for them as well. So what Caleb has tripped on, maybe not so accidentally or maybe accidentally, is he's got a business that's going to work well, in a couple of different plausible futures.
Thank you for calling, Caleb. That sounds great. I'll be following your venture. Yeah, but talk a little bit more about the future of leisure. That goes hand in hand with work. I mean, right now we hear about how we're all so crazy busy all the time, and we take our smartphones on vacation with us, and we continue to work, and it's going to be different.
Well, it could be. It's a it's a possible future. It's a plausible future. There are some people. There's a cohort of folks who call themselves the post-workists. The idea of what happens when we do get more leisure? What happens when we don't have to work as much? These are people who have advocated for a 32-hour work week, who say, and there's actually, from an economics perspective, there's a really good reason to go to a 32-hour work week, and that is, if we all went to a 32-hour work week, we would be creating more jobs for more people, rather than me hoovering up a 60-hour work week that could be split into two, or about approximately two. So there is a plausible future where we have more leisure, and it might seem almost like utopian, could this really happen? But I used to do a lot of work in public accounting, and when the recession hit in 2009, they knew that it would eventually come back. I mean, they're all bean counters. They knew that it would eventually come back, and they didn't want to lose their best people. So what a lot of the top 10 firms did was they said, how could we job share? So how could we all take a little bit of a haircut so that nobody has to go on unemployment or try to find a job during this terrible time? Because we know that when things rebound, we're going to need everyone again. So there have been, on a sort of a corporate by corporate case, situations where this has been a very populist solution to weather through an economic downturn.
Caleb mentioned that he is a grower, and I we didn't get to talk to him about that, but I'm thinking a farmer's market person and a farmer.
Yeah, would be my guess. Yeah,
and so what about the future of that kind of work?
Well, it's interesting. A couple years ago, I think it was 2012, for the first time ever in America, the average age of a farmer started to come down instead of up. I think it had been 58 was the average age of a farmer prior to 2012. So Caleb is, again, on the front lines of this movement of having younger people involved in agriculture, trying to, and I think some of it, frankly, is trying to be more sustainable in thinking about our food. I think some of it is not everybody wants to stare at a screen all day. Some of us still want to get our hands dirty. We want to make stuff. So I think, you know, there are a couple of different components to that. But what Caleb is experiencing as a young grower is he's got a cohort of people who are doing that right alongside him.
We're talking with Rebecca Ryan. She's a futurist and an economist. She is founder and owner of Next Generation Consulting. She is also resident futurist at the Alliance for Innovation, a senior fellow at CEOs for Cities, and senior advisor at the Governing Institute. And we are talking about the future workplace, talking about the future of work and workers, and welcoming your questions for her. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are discussing the future of work and workers with a guest futurist and economist who lives in Madison, who just completed a TED Talk on what the future will bring. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with Rebecca Ryan about what technology will do to our jobs, what kinds of jobs will be abundant in the future, talking about the sharing economy, the gig economy, the knowledge economy, and welcoming your questions for her, or maybe your what worries or excites you most about the future of work. Jacob in Ashland is with us. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Yeah, so it's more of a thought. We need to really stop thinking so much about, like, who we're going to work for and what our next job is going to be, and kind of do some soul searching and figure out, hey, what am I most passionate about and what can I do to make a livelihood for myself versus continuously working for other people. I think there's a lot of potential for us to be working for ourselves again and figuring out what our niche is. And for me, it's food. And I think a lot of people moving forward are going to need to learn how to grow their own food again and learn how to feed their communities and save their seeds. And, you know, that whole idea of the sharing economy is really important. And
You're growing food, Jacob.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. And some people are probably preparing that food, too. But what about that? We need to develop our own livelihoods based on our own passions.
You know, this is you hear this more and more among young people. Number one, they saw their parents go through the recession of the 80s. And they learned at a very early age around the dining room table that you couldn't count on one employer for job security. And that has had deep impact on the next generation. But when things can't be assumed, like I think about college students who are going to college today, you know, when they started college, they started in the middle of a recession. Now they're coming out and it's not too much better for entry-level workers. So that begs some soul searching, like the kind that Jacob is talking about. And the idea that the next generations, and I think this is actually happening across the spectrum, because I think about boomers too, as they are facing retirement. In America, work has always been this thing that we hang our hat of identity on. But I think increasingly people are saying, okay, wait, if that's not something we can assume that the job will be there, where do I really want to pour my resources, my time and energy and talents? And so it's work. The work we do is going to have to help us make meaning and not just money.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you a question. I just thought of it was, I believe it was Marco Rubio in one of the past presidential debates made a comment that we need more welders, not more philosophers, and I'm wondering if he's right.
I think we need a lot of welders. There's definitely a middle skills gap in the U.S., and I think what he's getting at is, you know, why are we continuing to send so many students away to four-year degrees when what we really need are people with two-year degrees? And in a way, he's right. However, what I would say is, when I think about future industries that are really going to create new wealth and create new prosperity, I think it is going to be the connection of, the head and the heart, the sciences and the arts. And so, therefore, we're going to need both of those folks. I'll tell you, some of my favorite people in the world are welders who are really armchair philosophers.
Let's go to Mark in Richland Center now. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. I like the sharing ideas. And if we used a different means of keeping track of who's done and who has not, you're there in Madison with the oldest running time bank, I think, in the entire country.
That's right.
And using a time credit system or an alternative crediting system would allow the people to do the kinds of work that they want to do in exchange with each other, even though they may be very short on regular dollars.
Oh, my goodness. I could just reach out and give you a hug, Mark. I prepared a document for the Alliance for Innovation that just came out in September called The Next Big Things, and it covers 44 trends that are going to affect cities and communities over the next 20 years. And one of the things that we talk about are local currencies. And you're right, Madison has the longest running, and I think the largest time bank in the world. And you know, the idea that, I mean, money is a fairly recent invention. The bartering economy is much older. And that's what time banks do. They allow you to say, I'm thinking of Rachel, who called in earlier. She can help you with your computer. So she gets paid a few hours in time bank, and then she doesn't know how to, maybe I'm having a situation with my plumbing at my house right now.
You and me both.
Is that right? Oh, lucky us. Maybe we should compare notes. But then you exchange that for somebody who can come in and snake your drain or whatever needs to happen there. What you're getting at here are alternatives around this traditional economy that is bound in the dollar and in the savings account. And the reason I love that idea is because at the end of the day, we cannot outrun our humanity. And we know, for example, that people who participate in a time bank economy have richer connections and more social cohesions in their communities. And that makes communities more resilient. And it's for the same reason that you have 10 times as many conversations at a farmer's market as you do when you go to a grocery store. So this is about more than the economy. This is about what our shared sense of community is. And I really appreciate your comment,
yeah,
Mark.
Thanks for that. Anybody need a talk show host? I need a new shower. We are talking about the future of work and workers and welcoming your questions for our guest futurist, economist Rebecca Ryan, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So what will the job of tomorrow, how different will that be of the job of today? What are the technological advances that are affecting your choice of a future job? How do you plan to navigate these challenges? Gary on Facebook says, I still have to mow the lawn and shovel the snow. Information technology and advanced machinery have not made people obsolete quite yet. But we seem to be getting closer to the point where all we have is to keep us occupied. We are getting to the point where all we have to keep us occupied is to keep each other entertained. Well, what about, people aren't obsolete quite yet.
No, people aren't obsolete, and you're absolutely right that as we think about the snowstorm coming.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, you can source those things out to TaskRabbit, or there's an app called Fancy Hands that will do you need to schedule a doctor appointment, it will do that for you. So we are even tasking those things out, outsourcing those kinds of things, mowing your lawn and so forth. But, you know, with respect to entertaining each other, it's interesting because the people who are leisure economists will say, that is what we're going to do. We're going to create more community. We're going to, more artists will be engaged with their work. So we're going to have a more creative community. We'll, you know, people will start picking up musical instruments again and entertaining each other,
cool.
You know, more campfire time. So that's and I think that's a positive thing. For every trend, there's always a counter trend. So I study trends for a living. And, when I think about the workaholism and the, you know, always being attached to your iPhone or your smartphone, there is a counter trend, which is less work, people bartering for more time off, people putting rules. There are several IT companies who have no email Tuesdays. The idea being, if you need to talk to somebody about something, go to their desk and talk with them about it. Don't rely on email. So counter trends are important too.
Now, was it Netflix, I think, and maybe another company that recently said you get unlimited time off, you get unlimited vacation if you work here. So are we going to have that kind of thing going on?
That is a really sexy policy from an HR perspective, because who doesn't want to work for a company where you get unlimited time off? But when you dig under that a little bit further, that doesn't mean your expectations for performance go down. So if you take, 40 weeks off and you are completely underperforming, you will also be fired. I think what that company is trying to do is really say, we recognize you're autonomous. Take the time you need to take and get your work done.
Uh-huh. Well, what about the future of policies that are in place for work-life balance? I mean, we still have debates over, this country doesn't have paid family leave, and other countries do. Are those debates going away?
They won't go away, and they shouldn't go away. And part of the reason is because women are crushing it in the American workplace. Right now, over 60% of all people who hold the job of manager or supervisor in the workplace are women. Women are on parity with men in law school, in medical school. We have elected the largest number of females to elected seats than we ever have. And, you know, no matter how you want to dice it, women still, if they have families, are responsible for most of the family care and logistics and things like that. So we do need family paid time off if we want this incredibly valuable resource, women, to be as productive as they can be.
Back to the phones. Jeff in Minocqua is with us. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Joey. Good morning to your guests. I just wanted to say that I thought if I worked for her father for a point of time for the West Penn Company, I grew up in the shadow of the factory there, which is now a flats and a rented out luxury apartment. Oh. But my thoughts, my concern was, what's your feelings on labor unions ever regaining their hold here in the state of Wisconsin, manufacturing in general?
Ah, the future of labor unions.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot, Jeff. And by the way, if you worked for Elmer Schwach, that was my dad. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the future of labor unions because one of the reasons that, you know, median wages have not kept pace is because we have fewer unions. You know, unions fight for those things, and the things that unions fight for tend to have ripple effects throughout the economy. The 40-hour work week was a union invention. But what I think has happened with the unions, and I feel like I could probably be, I don't know, slashed. My tires could be slashed for saying this. But what I feel like has happened with unions, and this happens with a lot of organizations, is they grow to a size where preserving their status as an entity becomes more important than the mission that they serve. So I think this is one of the things that has happened to unions. And instead of, you know, when I think about a teachers union, just generally, not specifically, but when I think about teachers unions, teachers unions should really be about making sure that students have high achievement and stable teachers who are, you know, able to provide, who are master teacher level. We know so much about how students learn. And if that was the halo hanging over the teachers unions, they'd be really hard to argue against, right? But when the purpose of a union becomes to preserve the union, that is harder to defend against. So I think this is just a natural course of what happens within organizations. Google will eventually get to the place, it's at 55,000 workers now, but they will eventually get to the size where preserving Google, right? Preserving maybe search or the money in search will become more important than maybe even Google's mission. It is a natural occurrence as entities grow.
Let's go next to Rose in Pewaukee. Hello, Rose. Rose, are you there? Yes, go ahead.
I love your show, and I agree with everything you're saying. I'm an internist, a physician, who really has been a futurist, and I created a private practice that is integrated. But the economy, the economic foundation of my practice relies on a sustainable economy. And I'm very interested in my practice in creating community and creating community health. So my emphasis really is on prevention and empowering people to take care of their health, to reduce health care costs, their own health care costs, and to create a sustainable medical pattern or medical system that is very different than corporate medicine, which is really money-driven, which is really driving us into the ground, I believe, and not really helping the health of our country. So I applaud everything that you're saying, and I have really been quite successful in creating that kind of a sustainable system in healthcare in Pewaukee, Wisconsin.
So the future of healthcare work.
You know, what she's doing is she's regenerating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talked about winter to spring at the top of the hour. What has to happen when you go from winter to spring? Well, you get a few people who are able to reframe a discussion. And what Rose has been able to do is reframe that healthcare should be about health, not sickness. And, she's right on time. She's right on time.
Yeah. So what should we be doing to regenerate right now?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are really key. And people can kind of dip into this anywhere they want. And the big promise from moving from winter to spring is that every other time we have been through this winter to spring turn, America has become a country that has worked better for more people. And if we do this in an appropriate way, we are setting the table for our kids and grandkids. But I think there are three major things, like when I look at the previous winter to spring turns. The first one is telling truths. Like Rose is a truth teller. The healthcare community and system should be about your wellness, not about your sickness. Keeping people well should be the purpose. Another thing that helps make the turn from winter to spring is when you reframe issues around what's coming, not what has been. So when anybody who's talking right now about bringing manufacturing jobs back to America, I feel like is maybe living in a bit of a time warp, because that's not what's coming. That's what has been. And the third and final thing is the ability for you to work across invisible lines. So when I think about the Caucasians who march with the African Americans in Black Lives Matter, or the straight people who were, you know, pro-gay marriage, or right now the young evangelical, there's a group of young evangelicals who have organized around climate action, and they've said to their elders, you know, we think the science kind of makes sense and we should be protecting the planet. And they've managed to cross this sort of invisible line saying that evangelicals don't believe in climate change. They've crossed it and they've said, we do believe in climate change and we think it's our job. So if you can find yourself in any of those three areas, I think you're going to be a force for spring.
We have just a minute left. In your TED Talk, you did also make the case that work is not the most important thing in our life. We have just a minute to go. Maybe could you tell us what is more important?
Well, when my dad was in hospice, I had a hospice nurse deliver me some religion, and her name was Kelly. She worked at Horizon Hospice, and she said, in life, we're all given five balls. One is rubber, and four are glass. She said, your rubber ball is work. If you drop it, it will bounce back, but your four glass balls are your family, your friends, your health, and your integrity. Those don't bounce. And so in this moment, this wintertime moment, this only comes once every four generations, and I think some of this generation's integrity is at stake. We have got to think beyond work. We are resetting the table for the next generation, and that's important work.
And that will stay with me for a while, too. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Troy.
Rebecca Ryan, futurist, economist, founder, and owner of Next Generation Consulting. And she was the lead author of a study that was identifying 44 trends for the future. It can be downloaded for free at the Alliance for Innovation's website. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.